From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. On the show today, Wellesley Police Chief Terrence Cunningham talks about his apology to communities of color and his call for healing.
The first step in this process is for the law enforcement profession to acknowledge and apologize for the actions of the past and the role that our profession has played in society's historical mistreatment of communities of color.
Also,
real change begins with immediately repealing and replacing Obamacare.
We'll get reaction from a key architect of state and national health care reform, Jonathan Gruber. Plus, remembering PBS news anchor Gwen Ifill.
Because when we talk about race in this country, we always talk about African Americans, people of color. I want to talk to you about white people, okay?
White people.
I know.
It's Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Wellesley Police Chief Terrence Cunningham has more than 30 years' experience in law enforcement. He's been Wellesley's chief for more than 15 years. And just last month, he finished his term as president of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, or the IACP. That's why people around the nation took notice in the middle of October when Cunningham spoke at the IACP's annual convention. He celebrated the nobility of law enforcement as a profession. And then he spoke frankly about policing's history as an oppressive force against people of color. Cunningham said that history has done damage to the basic relationship police have with the communities they serve, and that the damage has to be healed.
For our part, the first step in this process is for the law enforcement profession and the IACP to acknowledge and apologize for the actions of the past and the role that our profession has played in society's historical mistreatment of communities of color. At the same time, those who denounce the police must also acknowledge that today's officers are not to blame for the injustices of the past.
Well, Chief Terrence Cunningham joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Great. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So there's been so much that's been happening in the country in the past couple of weeks that it's hard to imagine that this was only a month ago that
Yes.
you gave this speech. Where were you when you decided that you wanted to tackle head on the injustices between law enforcement and communities of color? Why did you decide to do this?
That's actually a great question. In July, it was actually July 7th, I was down at IACP for a one-day meeting. And that evening, I went back to my hotel room and turned on the TV, and the Dallas shootings were unfolding. And as I watched the Dallas officers falling, I thought to myself, there's got to be more. I felt that I had an obligation and a responsibility in my position as the president of the IACP to do everything I could to, one, make sure that we keep our officers as safe as we can, and also to keep our community safe. And it was shortly after that, on that following Monday, I had a meeting with President Obama. There was a small group of us, nine of us, in the Roosevelt Room at the White House. The meeting went about 2.5 hours or so. The president was very frank in his comments to us. There were eight other organizations from law enforcement there. And at the end of that meeting, as the president got up to walk out, I said something to him that made him stop, and as he turned around and came back, he said, well, you know, Terry, we can't move this discussion forward if there's not some acknowledgement on the part of the police, and the police have to acknowledge that you know, their involvement in this historic mistreatment.
What did you say that made the president stop and turn around?
Well, to be honest with you, I'd rather keep that between myself and the president. But we had a very open and honest discussion for about 2 hours or 2 hours and 15 minutes, and I'll be honest, I did say to the president that as somebody who is a fervent supporter of reform, I believe completely in the president's 21st Century Task Force report and the tenets of that report. And as somebody who pushes reform all the time, it's very disheartening to me when I see the president stand up and presuppose guilt in some of these high-profile use of force cases and before the facts have actually come in. And we had a discussion about that. We talked about it, and he said that he didn't feel that he actually did that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you know, what he had just posted on his Facebook page just prior to that, right after the Castile and the Sterling shootings, I said, I think they show something different. And the president acknowledged that maybe he had.
So it was the president that encouraged you to do this acknowledgement, but you took it one step further in your speech, and I mean you issued an apology.
Right. So right after that meeting was on Monday. The next day, Tuesday, I was down in Dallas at the memorial service for the Dallas officers. And as I sat there, I was in the front section, and I looked over to my left, and I looked at the families of those officers, the fallen officers. And there were little kids crawling on their mothers' and fathers' laps because it was a three-hour wait because the two presidents mm-hmm. were there, so security was very tight. And as I looked at that, and I looked over at the five hats in the chairs that were there that had been placed for the officers, and the posters of the officers that had fallen. And then I looked up on the stage and I saw a number of Dallas officers up there, and I saw white officers, Hispanic officers, black officers, females and males. And again, I felt this overwhelming sense of responsibility to do everything I can to make sure that this something like this never happened again. And on the heels of the meeting the day before where the president said there needs to be some acknowledgement on the part of law enforcement for historical mistreatment of particularly minority communities and communities of color. And I thought to myself, well, if there's got to be an acknowledgement, maybe an apology would take it one step further where I could stop this from ever happening again so I could protect the officers and protect the communities. And I knew that it was going to be controversial, particularly in the law enforcement community. And that's why I wanted to make it clear that 99.9% of the officers out there go out there and mm-hmm. do an incredible job under extraordinary circumstances every single day.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're right, because there was a lot of reaction from within mm-hmm. the law enforcement profession. I'm seeing a quote here from William Johnson, who's the executive director of the National Association of Police Organizations, and he's quoted as saying, I mean, he called what you said appeasement. Mm-hmm. And he said, such appeasement of the violent anti-police movement is just one more nail in the coffin of American law enforcement. The people who support American police officers aren't looking for an apology, and for the people who hate the police, it won't make any difference.
I actually know Bill, and I couldn't disagree with him more. And I said that to him after he made those comments, because I did see him after that. I honestly, in my heart of hearts, believe that the right thing to do was to make that acknowledgement and make the apology, and now try to get people out of their corners so that we can start to have a conversation about how we can move forward and heal these communities of color. And I always go back to the President's Task Force report. When you read about police legitimacy and procedural justice and how important that is, not only to keep the community safe, but to keep the officers safe. If people feel in the community that what the police are doing are fair and just, then they are more apt to comply with the police officer's commands. And that's when we see people starting to get hurt. And you had folks, particularly high in the current administration, where they were saying that you should question authority and that you shouldn't comply with the officer's commands. And what happens is...
Specifically who?
Well, there were people within the administration that were saying that they felt that if the person felt like they were being treated unfairly or unjustly by the police, then they shouldn't comply with the commands of the officer. And unfortunately, what happens, and that's how they spiral out of control, those incidents spiral out of control, and that's how people end up getting hurt, and in some circumstances, people end up getting killed. There's an avenue for people to complain if they feel like the stop is unjust, or they feel like that they've been racially profiled, or they feel like the stop is illegal. There's an avenue for somebody to complain about that. The time isn't to arbitrate it on the street, and that's one of the issues.
Well, so let's take a step back here, Chief Cunningham, because I mean your statement and your speech to the IACP convention, as we began talking about, really it drew a lot of people's attention and focus, because it nothing like that had ever been said before in such a high profile a law enforcement setting. Mm-hmm. But as I read what you said and others have read also, you specifically say that law enforcement needs to apologize for its role in terms of the past treatment of communities of color, because as you say that in the past there were many unjust laws that law enforcement was tasked with enforcing. But I think, I mean, you know where I'm going with this. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say that may be true, but current mistrust isn't just based on history, it's based on the present, that mm-hmm. that many, many people feel that law enforcement officers are treating communities of color unjustly now, that there's racism going on now. And if you don't acknowledge that, there's no way to move forward.
Right. So a number of responses to that. First of all, I think every community wants their police department to reflect the community that they serve. Right? That's our goal. Do people think that there's racism and implicit bias in the community? Sure there is, in every community. And is that going to seep into some police departments at some level? Absolutely. It has to if you want your police department to reflect the community that they serve. So it's our job as police administrators to root that out. It's our job to make sure that we have some type of a matrix so that we can look at it and determine whether or not it's occurring. And if it is occurring, then to root it out of the department. And I would also say that when you look at the statistics, you look at the numbers, there's about 11 to 12 million arrests per year across this nation. About 12 million arrests. Mm-hmm. Any one of those arrests can go upside down in a second. So when you look at that, you've got to figure that, as I started this conversation, 99.9% of those officers out there are doing a great job under incredibly difficult circumstances. And they have to bat 1,000 every time they get up to the bat. And unfortunately, everything is being laid at the feet of the police at this point. So whether it's joblessness, homelessness, untreated substance abuse, mental illness, and the officers are put in this precarious position where they have to figure out how best to navigate all those things because nobody else knows what to do with it. So when I look at the officers of today, the job has changed. It's mm-hmm. it's a different job today than it was, you know, clearly 20 or 30 years ago when I first came on the police department. The role has changed, and now we need to recruit and retain individuals that reflect the current job tasks.
Demands
that,
of the job.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I want to get to that in just a second, but I also want to invite our listeners as well. We're speaking with Wellesley Police Chief Terrence Cunningham. Until just last month, he was the president of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, and he made a remarkable speech at the IACP's annual convention calling for reconciliation and healing and acknowledgement of law enforcement's role in historic mistrust between police officers and communities of color. If you've got a question for Chief Cunningham, call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Chief, before we get to these real issues that you were bringing up about the nature of the job today and who is recruited into law enforcement, I do want to explore that with you in detail in just a minute. I just want to back up a little here because I think we should spend a little bit more time on what people are saying and what researchers are saying about the reality in these communities of color where so many law enforcement officers do work day in and day out. And I acknowledge, absolutely, the majority of them bring that nobility that you talked to their jobs mm-hmm. every day. But there's, you know, of course, we wouldn't be having this conversation if there weren't concerns. And I was looking at some numbers, for example, from the Washington Post. They have been gathering data on police-related shootings and killings with the University of Louisville and the University of South Carolina. And they have found that, this is a quote from the Post, that the only thing that's significant in predicting whether someone is shot and killed by police if they're unarmed, was whether or not they were black. Crime variables did not matter in terms of predicting whether the person killed was unarmed. And then we also have the Justice Department's review of what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, and they found a pattern of unlawful conduct throughout the department. For example, nearly 90% of documented uses of force by Ferguson police were used on African Americans. I mean, there is data that goes back to what you were talking about earlier, that like any other community, law enforcement has these implicit biases.
Sure, it's no different than the legal profession, the medical profession, or the journalistic profession. That's always a possibility. And I want to make it clear, though, on the Ferguson report, there were actually two reports. There was the first report from the Department of Justice when they investigated the Michael Brown shooting with Darren Wilson, where they found that all the witnesses in that case had essentially lied. They'd perjured themselves. And it wasn't until the FBI came in and said, you know what, if you lie to us, you're going to go to jail. So that report made it clear that the Michael Brown shooting had been justified. The second report was about the systematic racism within the system.
Yep.
And there's no question about it. But something I think is really important for people to understand. One thing is, you know, in law enforcement, we do a great job figuring out these crime-fighting strategies where we can reduce crime in a community. And sometimes at what price to that relationship with that community? And whether it's stop and frisk or, you know, other techniques that have been used out there, where the balance gets shifted and the community says, that's enough. We're not going to tolerate. You drove the crime down enough. We're willing to tolerate some level of crime in our community so that we can have a good relationship with our police.
Right. Well, in the case of stop and frisk in New York State, it was found unconstitutional.
Right. No, right. That technique was. But there are other techniques that they use. The other piece that I think people really have to think about is we expect these officers to go out there and go from call to call to call. They don't think about the cumulative effect of the stress and the trauma on those officers every single day. We do a great job in the profession if there's some type of a critical incident that the officer's involved in, whether it be a shooting or a pursuit with an accident or something like that, where we get the officer the assistance that they need, we pull them off the road and get them the support that they need. But it's the cumulative effect of stress and trauma. If we expect those officers to do a great job and make really good decisions in some of these difficult, you know, situations that they're put in, then we have to take care of them. It's about officer safety and their wellness. So we, as a society, we need to think about that. We need to think about how we support the officers.
Absolutely. But I wonder if part of getting to that point is reaching a place where everyone involved in day-to-day interactions between law enforcement and communities of color can come to a place where they're having a conversation about, you know, the effects of the stress of the job, also the effects on the community in terms of the implicit bias that does undergird so many interactions. I mean, look, I just feel compelled. You mentioned Castile, Philando Castile, Alton Sterling, Sandra Bland, Laquan McDonald, Tamir Rice, Walter Scott. We could go on and on and on and on. There are so many names now. And I would also to that list add the names of the police officers who've lost their lives in the line of duty. But I mean, it just seems like what are your prescriptions? What are your ideas to get to a point where we can start rooting out the implicit bias that underlies the situations that lead us to have to name these names?
Right. So, well, to your last point, I mean, I think now we're up to 56 officers that have been killed in the line of duty as a result of gunfire. So far this year, that's a 70% increase over last year. It's just got to stop, number one. Number two, to the other high-profile use of force cases that you talked about, you know, you got to do a deep cut into each one of those instances, and we can't lump them all together. And you have to look at them. And when people talk about holding officers accountable, the Supreme Court was clear in Graham versus Connor. That's the threshold that we have to objective reasonableness when an officer has to use deadly force. Unfortunately, you know, one bad shooting is too many. But that's the Supreme Court has held that as the standard. Now, if an officer violates policy, there are other ways to hold an officer accountable aside from having the officer indicted and then sent to jail. So if they reach the Graham versus Connor standard, right, as set by the Supreme Court, then they should be protected from criminal prosecution as well as civil prosecution. Now, if they violated my policy, so for instance, the example is if I had a suicidal person in a house, the officer shows up there's only that person in the house by themselves, and they're threatening to kill themselves. The policy of the department should be to surround the house, call the person out, you know, make contact with them, try and talk them down, get hostage negotiators in there and talk to the person. If my officer violates my policy and goes in the house and then as a result has to use deadly force on that person, they should be held accountable. The officer should be disciplined and terminated if they violated the policy. So there's different ways to hold officers accountable. It doesn't always mean that they're indicted and go to jail.
So Chief, let me just jump in here because I take your point, your legal points here. Because yes, those are the standards, but let me bring it down to something even more basic. Something I know you've heard because it's been part of the national conversation for years now. What do you say to all those African American men African-American teenage boys who say, every time I interact with police or I come into contact with law enforcement, I'm afraid I'm going to get shot and killed because I'm black.
That's a different conversation. I couldn't agree with you more. And I've heard that over and over again from people anecdotally, and even people who didn't know that I was a police officer. I mean, I went to check into a hotel room recently where the manager was an African-American female, and her boyfriend is African-American, and she was afraid for his safety when he was out there in the street because she was afraid that he was going to be harmed by the police, and she didn't even know I was a police chief. So I take that to heart, and I understand that.
Because that's the basis of why, I think, of why you gave the speech you gave.
It is. So David Kennedy, who was with Harvard, now he's with John Jay, I had a conversation with him the other day, and David made it clear. He said, you know, as a Caucasian person, whether you're a police officer or you're a civilian, when you look at one of those high-profile use of force cases by the police, right, you look at it through the lens of being very pragmatic. You know, what led up to it? What happened? How did they get there? If you're African-American, he said, it doesn't matter whether you're a police officer or you're a civilian. You look at it through the lens of history. And that's just the filter that you put on it. So if we can start there and have the conversation about trying to, you know, there's no way we can turn the clock back, but at least if we can have that conversation. And I think it's really important to understand that one of my conversations with President Obama when I was speaking to him, he talked to the group. We had a larger meeting with a group of 50 or 60 community activists were there. And he talked about the fact, he said, you know what, I was a protester. And he said, when I protested, there was an end to the means. What is it that we're trying to get to? What is it that we're trying to accomplish here? And, you know, there are a couple of folks there from Black Lives Matter who, you know, kind of pushed back on the president a little bit. And he said, well, you know what? I've tried to bring you people into the White House and have a conversation with you. He invited people from Black Lives Matter to the Oval Office, and they said no because they didn't want to be co-opted by the president of the United States. Then he said, how can we have this discussion? So and that's where we are right now. I mean, we want to keep the community safe, and we need to keep our police officers safe.
Well, let's bring in some listeners into this discussion.
Great.
If we can. Let's turn – well, I just remind everyone, if you just joined us, we're speaking with Chief Terrence Cunningham. He's the chief of police for Wellesley, Massachusetts, and until last month, he was the president of the International Association of Chiefs of Police. So let's go to Hannah, who's calling from Worcester. You're on the air, Hannah.
Hi. I actually have a question for Chief Cunningham. I do respect our men and women in blue. I think they do, you know, a tough job, and a lot of people don't give them the credit for that. But I also see the side that there is a serious implicit bias in a lot of the community policing that goes on. So I just have a question for you, Chief Cunningham. What do you think about, a lot of people are either pro Black Lives Matter or pro Blue Lives Matter, especially on social media. We see a lot of backlash one against the other, and what is your thought about why it's so hard for people to admit to be both?
Well, that's a great question. I'd like to answer the point about the implicit bias. One of the things that we've been trying to do, IACP has been trying to do, is we don't know. There's really nothing evidence-based to look at whether or not implicit bias training with the police is actually effective or it's not effective. And when I look at it and we talk about training, a lot of people think we can just train our way out of this and, you know, give the police more training on policing in a democratic society, you know, implicit bias, you know, whatever it is, police legitimacy, procedural justice. And I don't see it as a training point. I see education is more important because this training is trying to develop a skill, and education is really more about knowledge and intellect. And I think that's the point that we need to get to. And if people can understand and try to walk in somebody else's shoes, you have to get to their knowledge and their intellect. And I think that's the point where you can get where people can say, it's not Blue Lives Matter, it's not Black Lives Matter, it really is All Lives Matter. And I even, when we have this discussion, I don't even like to say people on the other side of it when I use that term, because they disagree with it, because you know what, the police really are the community. They're part of the community. And if you look at the statement that I think it was, I want to say it was Montrell Jackson, who was the officer from Baton Rouge, that posted that posting on Facebook, and he talked about what it was like being an African-American man outside of his uniform, and then he talked about the look of disdain that people gave him when he put his uniform on. I mean, he said it all. It really is just about saving everybody's lives here and trying to make the communities and the police safer.
Let's take another call. Patricia is calling from Dorchester. You're on the air, Patricia.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I would just like to ask if there are children or grandchildren involved for our death, what he tells them as far as when they encounter the police, especially in their teen years. Do you have a conversation with them about if the police stop you, this is what you do? Because I'd like to share with you what parents of color have to tell their children when they're when they encounter the police.
Yeah, Patricia, tell us. Go ahead.
So you don't just tell your kids, okay, it's just the police, there's no problem. You have to say things to them like, okay, don't make any sudden moves. Make sure you do whatever you do, whatever they say, and things like that. You really shouldn't have to do that, but that's what people do to keep their children safe. And I would agree and say, yes, when the police stop you, if you're a person of color, do what they say so you can get home alive. And I don't mean that everybody is going around killing everybody. That's not what I'm saying. But we live in a very real society, so now we have to look at, I'll just say this, the election results say a lot about this country and where we are.
Well, Patricia, thank you so much for your call. I'm just going to take it back from you so I can let Chief Cunningham respond, but thank you for your call.
So I didn't hear the first part of her question, but I think it was what I tell my children.
Yeah.
So I've got a stepson and a stepdaughter, and I essentially have told them the same thing, that when you're stopped by the police, turn your interior light on, keep your hands on the steering wheel, no furtive movements, and be polite and respond to their commands and their requests. But believe me, it's not lost on me the difference between being stopped as a Caucasian, being stopped as an African American, particularly a young African American male.
So we got a lot more callers who want to join us, and we're just flat out of time. I'm really sorry about that. But I do want to ask you one more question, and kind of inspired by what Patricia was saying there at the end of her call, and that is that there were several law enforcement organizations that endorsed now President-elect Trump during the campaign. I just wonder what your thoughts are, because President Obama has made a cameo in this conversation several times. Of course, he's going to be ending his term in office on January 20th, and we will have a new president. How do you think this conversation can, should, will continue under a President Trump?
So we actually, the IACP, we sent presidential questionnaires to both Secretary Clinton and to Mr. Trump back in, I think it was July or August, got responses from both of them, and they're both posted to the public site of the IACP website if somebody wants to look at them. 10 questions, multi-part questions. And from our standpoint, we don't endorse the ICP, we don't endorse candidates, presidential candidates, but we're really interested in the policy piece in this. There's a lot of talk on both sides about what's going to happen and how the Department of Justice is probably going to look a lot different than it looks right now. And we want to make sure from the IACP standpoint that that the profession gets the support that they need. But the thing that we have said over and over again is, the overarching issue that we're talking about here is the system needs to be looked at. So we have requested, the IACP for the last 20 years have said, we need to have a national commission on criminal justice, because this isn't just a police issue. So we would ask the administration that they, either through executive order or through Congress, that they stand up this National Commission on Criminal Justice. We look at the courts, the prosecution, juvenile justice. We look at the whole system, because the last time that was done was 1967. And then let the administration start to form their policies based on what the commission says.
Do you have confidence that that might happen with a Trump administration?
I actually do have confidence in it. And again, I go back to President Obama. When we first asked President Obama to do that through an executive order, he was reluctant to do it. And then in the end of his administration, back in July and August, he said he wished he had done it, but now he didn't have the time to do it. So we've had some initial conversations with people that have contact in the Trump potential Trump administration, and said this has got to be a priority for you. I mean, people want to talk on both sides of these issues, but this is one way they can be concrete about trying to form their policy decisions.
Yeah. Well, Chief Cunningham, it's been really great to talk with you, and let me just issue you an invitation. I'd love to have you come back, and because there's a lot of sort of ideas in terms of police training and recruitment,
sure,
and community relations that we didn't get a chance to talk about
today. I'd love to come back and have that
discussion.
Will
you do that sometime?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Terrence Cunningham has been a police officer in Wellesley, Massachusetts for more than 30 years. He is the chief of police in Wellesley, and he just finished his term as the International Association Chiefs of Police, the president of the IACP. Chief Cunningham, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Pioneering journalist Gwen Ifill died yesterday. She was just 61. You likely know her from her stellar work as the host of PBS's Washington Week in Review and co-host of the NewsHour. Ifill also had a long career in print journalism, more than 80 front-page bylines in the Washington Post, stints at the Baltimore Evening Sun and the New York Times. She got her start in Boston. Her first job after graduating from Simmons College was in the late 1970s at what was then called the Boston Herald-American. And in an industry still struggling with a woeful lack of women of color, Ifill's intelligence, authority, toughness, and grace will be sorely missed. So joining us now to remember her is Helen Drinan. She's the president of Simmons College. President Drinan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Well, thank you, Meghna.
We're also joined now by Sarah Just. She's the executive producer of PBS's NewsHour, where, of course, Gwen Ifill was the co-host, as we mentioned. Sarah Just, welcome to you as well.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you both. Of course, I'm so sorry that it has to happen under these circumstances, because I do believe journalism has lost one of its leading lights. I just want to ask you both first, your just reflection on Gwen Ifill as a journalist. Sarah, let's start with you. I mean, what have we lost?
We really have, as you said, just lost one of the great icons of the industry. Gwen was a widely admired throughout the industry for her fairness and her toughness and her integrity. She had been a successful print reporter before making the transition to television, not an easy transition. She did it beautifully. She was a great debate moderator as well, and just she had an immense amount of compassion and curiosity that she brought to her journalism.
And Helen Drinan, your thoughts?
Meghna, you talked about the image that she has had in the whole world, and I would say we have lost a wonderful role model for mm-hmm. all women who aspire to journalism and the communications world, a world both of you know better, much better than I, the competitiveness and the nature of really being at your best to make it in that world. Especially, I think we've lost that role model for young women of color. There are not very many of those wonderful role models. And so she is in a category of her own, and we've lost her.
Yeah. Well, I want to actually take us a little back in time a bit to the beginning of Gwen Ifill's career, because as we mentioned, it began in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And right from the start, she showed, again, that intelligence and strength that was her hallmark as a journalist mm-hmm. In later years. So we have a little tape of Gwen Ifill speaking. She was at Colorado College just in September, talking about the event in the 1970s, again, at the then Boston Herald-American, that actually got her career started.
I got my very first job at a newspaper because someone left a racial slur for me at my workspace when I was interning. And as horrifying as it was, I have to say my first reaction was, I wonder who this is for. Is this for me? And then I realized it was. But my bosses were so horrified that they offered me a job if I ever wanted one. Now, I had no intention of going back to work for these racists, right, until I couldn't get a job, at which point I went back and said, did you say you had a job? And it got me into the business. And so as horrifying as it was, I didn't spend a lot of time, you know, weeping over the terrible insult. I was able to use it to my advantage.
It's that part where she says she didn't spend a lot of time weeping over an awful insult. I mean, Sarah, just talk to me about that part of Gwen Ifill as a person. You must have seen that in her work at the NewsHour all the time.
Yeah, and she told that story to me and to other folks here, by way of explaining exactly that you don't linger on the hurts, you focus on moving forward, although you don't excuse the hurts. And that was, that always seemed to be part of her approach. She did not, wallow in self-pity about anything, and she did not decry the injustices of the world. She looked to understand them, to move forward, to take advantage of whatever opportunities lay ahead so that she could do the work that she wanted to do, which was tell great stories and shine light on the truth in the world.
And Helen Drinan, you were at Simmons as an undergrad at the same time Gwen Ifill was, right?
As a grad student.
She was okay.
Here. Yeah.
I mean, 1970s Boston, right? A very different place than the city is today. She must have, and she was actually, later on when she, at the Boston Herald-American, she eventually covered schools, right?
So, yes,
so,
she did.
So, I mean, it must have been not infrequent that she encountered the kinds of challenges that she laid out in that piece of tape.
Well, I think that's right. And I think one of the things that Gwen did very, very well is to take something away from an incident like that, but keep her stride. And I think, you know, we have so much conversation today about whether universities and colleges are coddling kids and not allowing them to really deal with real issues of the world. And I think Gwen's experience here at Simmons was, I learn and I grow. And I think that's a great model, especially in today's environment, to say there will be failures, there will be insults, but you pick yourself up and you keep going. And if you pick yourself up and you keep going and you become one of the first two women to run an evening news program, you've done a lot with those injustices. Mm.
You know, Gwen Ifill talked about how in her early days in the newspaper business, there were, quote-unquote, a lot of old white guys who had never seen anything like her, you know, a college-educated African-American woman. And she once told in an interview that they just, an interviewer, that those old white guys just didn't know how to deal with her. I mean, Sarah, just, I even as far as we've come, I wonder if that's a challenge or a reality that Gwen Ifill felt that she never really could step away from.
Well, I think she always knew that her gender, her race, this was part of who she was and how people saw her. And even though the world has changed and improved in many, many ways, she was, you know, very keenly aware of all the continuing injustices and problems. And one of the things that she did that was just so remarkable, and I'm really even learning about further since in the hours since her death yesterday, is how much she mentored and reached out to people who were coming up. So, for instance, we had Yamiche Schalzendorf from the New York Times on the program yesterday, who I knew that Gwen had mentored and communicated with. And I assume when she told me that it was just in the past year, since Yamiche has been covering the presidential campaign for the New York Times, come to find out yesterday she'd actually been in touch with her all through her college experience and had been guiding her and supporting her and welcoming her to meet other women, African-American women in the business in Washington, and just really felt a obligation to keep making that, helping someone along in that process. And she did it with many other young people in our newsroom and elsewhere, because she knew that, you know, there hadn't been those mentors for her, but that it was her obligation to continue to pass along the guidance and to make it easier for future generations.
Yeah. Helen Drinan, how was Gwen Ifill as an alumna of Simmons? I mean, was her effect and her example and her mentorship felt by students at Simmons?
Oh, students at Simmons adore her, as I might say does the faculty who remain at Simmons, and there are actually quite a few remaining here who worked with Gwen as a student. She's just everything to our students. I will say that I think that her availability to her alma mater was unquestionable. She would, whenever I would need to reach her, she would take my call practically no matter what else was going on, with a few exceptions. And she was just, she was a great advocate for women's education and for what she took away from here. Mm. Yeah.
You know,
I would echo that. She and I talked about women's education often, and it was important to her. She was proud of Simmons. I grew up in Boston myself. I went to school near Simmons, and we often talked about what a special experience women's education was, and how much it meant to her.
Yeah. You know, in this, her voice was obviously very much missed in the last month or so of the election. And Sarah, I guess my last question to you is, how much more are we going to miss her as we move forward, into a new presidential administration?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we're never going to stop missing her here at the NewsHour and Washington Week and in journalism in general. But, you know, we're going to honor her legacy and her memory by doing the kind of journalism that she admired and would have been proud of. And that's a really high bar. And as we talk about stories in our newsroom, there are a lot of tears in wishing she were with us. But there's also a lot of pride in knowing that she taught us a lot, and was a wonderful colleague in doing the kind of work. We know what she liked and what she didn't respect, and we will keep that as a guide as we continue to do great journalism that hopefully she would have admired.
Well, Sarah Just is executive producer of the NewsHour on PBS. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Helen Drinan, president of Simmons College. It's always a pleasure to have you, President Drinan. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Magna.
I just want to read a little excerpt from a 2009 interview that Gwen Ifill gave to Julian Bond. She said, "You can't spend a lot of time assuming the worst about why people do things. It almost always has nothing to do with you and everything to do with them. It has to do with their biases, their constraints, their inability to imagine anything more." And then she went on to say, "It's my job then. It's a tougher job than my white counterparts have, but it just is what it is. It's my job to force them to see me in a different role. And then you act on that." That's Gwen Ifill back in 2009. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. President-elect Donald Trump has not been shy about his plans for the Affordable Care Act. Here he is on CBS last Sunday telling journalist Leslie Stahl that he has a plan to seamlessly end Obamacare and then implement his own agenda.
We're going to do it simultaneously. It'll be just fine. That's what I do. I do a good job. You know, I mean, I know how to do this stuff. We're going to repeal it and replace it.
But later in that same interview, he also said he'd actually keep two essential parts of Obamacare.
Are you going to make sure that people with preconditions are still covered?
Yes, because it happens to be one of the strongest assets.
You're going to keep that.
Also, with the children living with their parents for an extended period, we're going to
try and keep that.
Adds cost, but it's very much something we're going to try and keep.
Well, joining us now is someone who is intimately familiar with Obamacare. He was one of the president's senior advisors on the Affordable Care Act and also an architect of Massachusetts' landmark health care reform, Jonathan Gruber, professor of economics at MIT. Professor Gruber, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be here.
All right. So first of all, respond to what Donald Trump has been saying over the past couple of days, that he would keep two essential provisions of Obamacare. Can you do that and dismantle the rest of the Affordable Care Act? Is it possible?
Well, you have to think about this in two steps. So first step is he's mentioned keeping the exclusion of pre-existing conditions, the ban on that. Now, that's in principle a good idea. In practice, it doesn't work because, remember, what Americans want and what the Affordable Care Act did is an insurance market that does not allow insurers to discriminate against the sick. That involved not just banning pre-existing conditions exclusions, but also banning the ability of insurers to deny insurance coverage based on health, and also banning the ability of insurance companies to charge more based on health. So, for example, my wife's a breast cancer survivor. Under what Donald Trump mentioned, if she goes to the insurer could say to her, well, you know, if we offered you insurance, we'd have to cover your breast cancer, but guess what? We're not going to offer you insurance. We're going to charge you $100,000 a month. There's nothing in what he mentioned that stops that. So really, he has not said anything useful so far in terms of actually addressing the core issues that face Americans today, which is the uncertainty they'll face if Obamacare's repealed.
Well, so let me just take this a step further. I've seen some health economists say, if you insist on keeping pre-existing conditions, and also the ability for parents to insure their children for longer periods of time, that in order for those two things to work economically, you have to have a large pool of young, healthy people who have insurance, who essentially are subsidizing the expensive care of those other folks. And when you look at all that together, you end up with Obamacare all over again.
You know, and that's the second level. So the first, as I said, there's two levels. One is, be clear on Trump's point, was not addressing what Americans care about. Now, let's say Trump said, oh, no, I want to do what Americans care about. I want to make insurance. I'm going to end all insurance market discrimination. Well, that you can't do without the mandate and the subsidies. Because if you tell insurers you have to charge the same price to the sick and the healthy, which is what Americans want, but you tell people you can wait until you're sick to buy insurance, then insurers can't make money. They'll say, wait a second, I have to charge the same amount of money to the sick and healthy, and yet I'm only getting guys come to me when they're sick. I'm going to lose money. I'm leaving. This is not an idle conjecture. We've tried this experiment before. In the 1990s, seven states, including our home state, tried that well-meaning, well-intentioned reform of saying we're going to ban insurance market discrimination, do nothing else. And every state, including our home state, it caused the collapse of the insurance market. Hmm. It simply doesn't work.
Well, so let me ask you, since you mentioned Massachusetts, say that Obamacare nationally is repealed.
Hmm.
Would that have any effect on the healthcare, the health insurance market here in Massachusetts, because we had our landmark healthcare reform law prior to Obamacare?
It would have no effect on our insurance market. It would, however, have an effect on the financing of our law. So basically, when we did our landmark law, we essentially put money in from the state coffers to make it work. What Obamacare did, thanks to John Kerry, is Obamacare came back and said, you know what, we're going to repay you for all the money you sort of fronted us in experimenting to lead this design. Now, if that money goes away, then that's a hole in the Massachusetts budget that would have to be filled.
Hmm. Now, I mean, obviously you were very much a fan of Obamacare and Massachusetts health care law. You were instrumental in crafting both of them. Is there anything that Donald Trump has said over this, you know, the past year about his ideas for health care reform that you think are feasible? I mean, what about, he was talking about, you know, introducing more competition within the states amongst insurers. I mean, tell me, why is that a good idea? Or if not, why not?
You know what? It's neither a good idea nor a bad idea. It's an irrelevant idea. Three states have already tried it, and not a single insurer is interested in selling cross state lines. I mean, basically, it's a typical, you know, good sounding but meaningless talking point. Donald Trump has not offered any real solutions that would solve the enormous problems that would arise the Affordable Care Act.
Why aren't the insurers interested in selling across state lines? I mean, you'd think it would open a more bigger market to them.
You'd think it would, but remember, the barrier to selling across state lines is not insurance market regulations. It's setting up doctor networks. And they just don't want to go. If they want to sell in another state, they would have gone and set up the doctor networks already. The fact that you get rid of insurance market regulations doesn't actually bother them. Either they'll go in and set up the networks or not. But the bottom line is, you know, less the details and more, the Affordable Care Act fundamentally accomplished three things. Okay, we ended discrimination in insurance markets, we covered 20 million people, and we slowed the overall growth of healthcare spending in the U.S. Unless Trump has a plan which can accomplish those three things, he is making America step backwards from the ACA.
But on the other hand, I mean, we just recently, as you well know, President Obama announced that premiums for mid-level health plans are increasing roughly 22% for the next year on average. And then, you know, obviously, but the range is quite large from state to state. I mean, that led Donald Trump to say the Affordable Care Act is, quote, blowing up. I mean, he's not wrong that people are feeling the financial pinch of these rising premiums. I mean, that is a problem that does need fixing immediately, does it not?
Well, let's be clear that you're right about that 22% fact. Let me tell you three other facts that haven't gotten press coverage. First of all, that 22% increase brings us to a level which is lower than we would have been without the law. Premiums increased by 40%. In the 3 years before the law. In the 3 years since the law, they've increased by less than 40%. So first of all, the law has made things better. But it hasn't caused healthcare costs to go down. It never would. Nothing has caused healthcare costs to go down. They're always going up. The question is, do they go up more slowly? And here we come to the other fact that's ignored. The numbers you're talking about, the 22% increase, that applies to a population of about 6 or 7 million people who are buying individual insurance without subsidies. A population more than 20 times as big is those with employer-sponsored insurance, most of your listeners. It's important to recognize that since Obamacare has been passed, the premiums for employer-sponsored insurance have fallen by $3,100 relative to what was expected. Yes, they've gone up, but they've gone up way more slowly than what was expected. And that's many, many more people. So we're focusing on this 22% number for a small slice of people, ignoring the enormous benefits Obamacare has delivered to all people with employer-sponsored insurance.
Well, Jonathan Gruber, we literally have about 40 seconds to go here.
Okay.
My last question for you is that you have a new Congress, you have a new president. I mean, if there's an area of the Affordable Care Act, forget the repeal and replace, even though that's might be what happens, but if there's a part of the ACA that you could tweak, what would it be?
I think you could easily tweak, for example, the employer mandate. That's not a really critical part of the law. It's got the word mandate in it, so it solves some of the political, you know, problems of saying I'm taking on the mandate, but it's not really an essential part of the law, and I think that would be an easy thing to tweak.
Well, Jonathan Gruber is a professor of economics at MIT. He's one of the architects of President Obama's Affordable Care Act and also of Massachusetts' landmark health care reform that preceded the ACA. Professor Gruber, we'd love to have you back as we figure out what will be happening to the ACA in the coming months and years.
Always happy to join.
Thanks again. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.